morning. May it please the court, my name is Bridget Boyle Saxton, and I represent Mr. Zaki Rahim. There are two issues that were presented for review in this matter. The first issue is whether or not the district court erred in not allowing Mr. Rahim to withdraw his plea. The second issue is whether or not the district court erred in a determination of the loss amount that was at issue in this matter. As to the first issue, the standard of review is whether or not the district court abused its discretion. And there's no question under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 32E, a defendant may withdraw a plea of guilty if the defendant shows any fair and just reason. Furthermore, it states that a hearing should be granted if the defendant offers substantial evidence that impugns the veracity of the plea. In this matter, the trial counsel, which I was not, I was hired for the appeal only, trial counsel submitted a motion asking the court to allow the defendant to withdraw his plea. He did not attach any affidavits, and he did not offer anything but the specific moving papers requesting the ability for the defendant to withdraw his plea. In that moving papers, the defendant stated through his lawyer that, one, he did not understand the charges at the time that he entered the plea, two, that he was not aware of the evidence that was going to be used to substantiate the charges, and three, that he was innocent. The district court found that the previous answers of the appellant, specifically at the time the plea was taken, and also at previous court appearances that the defendant had made, that there is a presumption that the plea was taken appropriately, and therefore the court did not require an evidentiary hearing on the motion. And furthermore, the court found that it took great care when it took the plea, and at the time that the plea was taken, the appellant indicated that he was guilty. Throughout the course of the transcript at the time of the plea colloquy, there are certain things that are somewhat problematic, specifically with the colloquy that the district court had with the defendant. For instance, at the time the court asked the defendant, "What is your plea?" the defendant responded with, "Yes, I received it." It continues in the transcript to indicate things like the court asking, so then what is your plea? The appellant responded with, "I don't know how I have to do this. They know they send me the check." The district court asked, "Do you agree that you are guilty?" And the appellant responded with, "That's what they feel." And lastly, the court asked, "You're pleading guilty because you are guilty. Is that right?" And the appellant said, "No, that is not correct." I submit to the court that those types of answers that the defendant gave at the time when he was going through the plea colloquy with the defendant certainly give some indication that there was some problems with the defendant's comprehension of what the court was asking him. The court found that based upon the entire record that he is not entitled to withdraw his plea, and therefore an evidentiary hearing was not even held in the matter. On behalf of the appellant, I submit that he should have been at least entitled to an evidentiary hearing in order to ascertain what he did or did not understand at the time of the plea colloquy. Furthermore, it is apparent from the record and also from the information contained in the trial court record that he is a person whose first language is not the English language. The district court inquired of him at the time when it began that plea colloquy whether or not he understood the English language, and it was indicated that he sometimes understands things and he sometimes does not understand things.
What did he mean? Didn't he say at some point that he didn't authorize his attorney to make a motion to withdraw the guilty plea?
Yes, sir. At the time of, I believe that was the time of sentencing, mm-hmm. There was an issue in regards to acceptance of responsibility points. And I believe at that time the appellant took the witness stand and was asked some questions about a multitude of things. One of the questions that came up was in regards to this motion to withdraw. And it's my recollection from the transcripts that he indicate that he did not authorize his lawyer to do that. Obviously, I think the record's clear that the lawyer did file the motion to withdraw, so therefore, at some point in time, it was authorized.
So he just said that to, what, make it better to accept responsibility?
I think that that is probably one assumption one could make, because I certainly know during that colloquy and that testimony of the appellant that there were some other issues that the appellant contradicted himself on about whether or not he did really accept responsibility if he did commit the crime. I know Mr. Campbell of the United States Attorney's Office questioned him about some of those things, and it came down to acceptance of responsibility was not appropriate based upon the filing of the motion to withdraw and also statements that he made during that brief testimony that was taken at that time. The second issue that I have presented in on behalf of Mr. Rahim is whether or not the trial court determined the loss amount correctly. This case is somewhat different than most because it is so close to the $70,000 mark. It ends up that the loss amount was determined by the trial court at $70,241, I believe. Therefore, this issue is very important on behalf of Mr. Rahim because if hypothetically the loss amount was determined to be below $70,000, that would be a reduction in obviously 2 points under the guidelines. At the time that this issue arose during the sentencing hearing, there was no testimony that was taken. Instead, on behalf of the government, Mr. Campbell made some statements to the court as to how things were determined, and also a Mr. Williams made some statements to the court as to how things were determined. There was no testimony to the trial court in order for the trial court to make a determination what the actual loss calculations were on in this matter. Under the notes under 2B1.1 of the sentencing guidelines, the loss calculations must be determined on at least through evidence set forth to the court, and the court must make a determination based upon that evidence. In this matter, we do not have any type of testimony, any type of documentation, except for the statements made in some sort of offer of proof. In that regard, the appellant submits to this court that this matter should be remanded to ascertain whether or not the loss amount is actually $70,241 or if it is less than that. Thank you very much. If there are no further questions.
Thank you. All right, counsel. May I ask you first why you didn't file a plea agreement?
Judge, that I thought it was part of the record. If it was something I should have attached to the brief, I apologize.
I would look at that after this if I were you. That's the heart of your case.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Scott Campbell. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I'd like to address the appellant's issues in order. First, as the issue of whether the district court erred in denying the appellant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea without a hearing, I'd point out first, as one of the members of the panel alluded to previously, Mr. Rahim did waive this issue, and he waived the issue by disavowing the motion to withdraw the guilty plea during his sentencing. Mr. Rahim's trial counsel contended during the sentencing hearing that his motion to withdraw the guilty plea was motivated not by a desire to, as he put it, avoid responsibility, but rather was simply an effort to avoid Mr. Rahim's going to jail. And then trial counsel put Mr. Rahim on the stand, and Mr. Rahim offered testimony. As part of his testimony, he suggested that he had not specifically authorized his counsel to move to withdraw his guilty plea, but again, that he was simply fearful of going to jail. So in essence, Your Honors, at sentencing, Mr. Rahim disavowed the motion, so he really has waived this issue and has extinguished any right to appellate review of the issue, because in essence he's saying, I never filed this motion, and now having said that, he should not be entitled to appellate review of the issue of the court's denial of that motion, since he has already distanced himself from it and has said it wasn't my motion. Moreover,
how about the answer that he gave? at the time that the court asked him if he understood it and did he want to plead guilty.
Well, I think counsel
Don't
had...
Don't you think that's confusing?
No, Your Honor.
It isn't.
It isn't, and it isn't for several reasons. The trial court found that Mr. Rahim's claims of confusion were disingenuous, and I'd refer the court to our citations to the record that the trial court's findings during sentencing. The trial court pointed out that Mr. Rahim's claims of confusion that Mr. Rahim made at sentencing were unbelievable and were disingenuous for the reason that Mr. Rahim has been in this country for a long time. The record reflects that he's been here since 1978, and the district court pointed out that Mr. Rahim had operated a business and had been a successful businessman. So the court found that Mr. Rahim's claims of confusion were unbelievable. Additionally, Your Honor, I point out that during the sentencing hearing, or during the change of plea hearing, Mr. Rahim twice said that he was pleading guilty because he was in fact guilty. And we have to remember, as this court has pointed out in numerous opinions, the district court is really in the best position during the Rule 11 proceeding to make a determination as to whether the plea is knowing and voluntary. And the record contains ample evidence here that that the plea was in fact knowing and voluntary. But before I get to that, I'd just like to lay one other foundation, and that is that besides having waived this issue as to whether the court erred in or properly exercised discretion in denying the motion to withdraw the guilty plea without a hearing, that motion failed on the merits as well for the very reasons the district court denied it, and that is that Mr. Rahim had the burden of offering some substantial evidence impugning the validity of his plea, yet he chose, for plainly strategic reasons, to offer no evidence whatsoever. Having failed to do that, he gave up any right to have an evidentiary hearing. And in fact, Your Honor, the government pointed out in its response brief to Mr. Rahim's motion to withdraw the guilty plea that he had failed, essentially, to provide his ticket of admission. He had failed to offer any evidence that would entitle him to an evidentiary hearing. So on the existing record, his motion should be denied summarily. In the face of that response from the government, Mr. Rahim chose not to file any further evidence. He filed no reply brief, and the district court found that persuasive. And at sentencing, when Mr. Rahim tried to distance himself from that motion, his counsel pointed out that Mr. Rahim should not be denied acceptance points because he had offered no evidence, no testimony, no affidavit in which he tried to deny acceptance of responsibility. So this was a very strategic move on Mr. Rahim's part, and he must bear the consequences. And the consequence is that when he chose not to impugn the validity of his plea, and he had at least twice during that change of plea hearing said, I am pleading guilty because I am guilty, he gave up the right to have a hearing on that motion to withdraw the guilty plea. And that takes us down to the fundamental question of, did the district court act correctly in relying upon the then existing record, that is, the record from the plea colloquy itself, in determining that Mr. Rahim's plea was knowing and voluntary? Your Honor, Judge Coffey, you pointed out at the outset that the government should have filed a plea agreement in that case, and again, I apologize for having failed to do that. I was under the misapprehension that was in the record. But in any event, in that plea agreement, Mr. Rahim did state that he was pleading guilty because he was guilty, and he affirmed that he understood the nature of charges against him and the elements of those charges. In fact, the elements were set forth expressly in the plea agreement itself. But even setting aside the plea agreement, if you look just at the Rule 11 proceeding itself, Mr. Rahim agreed to advise the court if he didn't understand, and he asked for the proceeding, but at no point during the proceeding did he indicate any comprehension problems. To the contrary, he cogently responded to virtually all the questions the court put to him, and contrary to Mr. Rahim's suggestions, he did not simply give a series of automaton-like yes answers to those questions. Rather, he gave narrative responses regarding his education and his work history. He answered no on several occasions, I believe four occasions, between pages 4 and 8 of the change of plea transcript, and he also expressly affirmed that he had sufficient time to confer with his attorney, that he was satisfied with his attorney, that he reviewed the indictment, and that he understood he had read the plea agreement and discussed it with his attorney, and that he understood the nature of the charges against him and the elements of those charges. After listening to the government's offer of proof or the factual proffer underlying the plea, Mr. Rahim conferred with his attorney and then offered several minor modifications to the proffer. this court has observed in its Underwood opinion that when a defendant intelligently responds to a government's proffer and then pleads guilty, that guilty plea is knowing and voluntary. So I suggest, Your Honors, that the record from the Rule 11, the change of plea proceeding, amply demonstrates that Mr. Rahim's guilty plea was in fact knowing and voluntary. And when he failed to offer any evidence impugning the validity of that plea, he gave up any right to hold a hearing as to whether the underlying plea was valid or not. And I do have a record cite. Record item 49 is the sentencing transcript. At pages 53 and 54 and 56, the trial court, which again had the opportunity to observe Mr. Rahim's demeanor, specifically rejected his claim of confusion. Finally, as to whether his plea was unequivocal, at pages 17 through 19 of the change of plea transcript, it is true that he did hedge at one point as to whether he's going to plead guilty or not, but he did unequivocally state on the record, yes, I am pleading guilty, and he also specifically attested twice that he was pleading guilty because he was in fact guilty. Those occur, Your Honor, at pages 17 and 19 of the change of plea transcript. As to the second issue that Mr. Rahim raises, and that concerns the calculation of his guideline sentence, I suggest, Your Honors, as a threshold matter, he waived this issue in his plea agreement. I would refer the court to the plea agreement, which I believe is in the record, is item number 23, at least the printout suggested that it was item 23 of the record, paragraph 28.
I can tell you that it isn't in the record.
Judge, I apologize.
Will you see that it is filed within 10 days?
Absolutely. I relied upon the printout of what was supposed to be in the record, and I have no explanation as to why it was not in the record.
Supposed to check it before it comes out.
I'll make sure that is filed with the court forthwith. But at paragraph 28 of that plea agreement, Mr. Rahim, quote, knowingly and voluntarily waived his right to appeal his sentence in this case, and now I'm paraphrasing, provided that a sentence was not, quote, in excess of the statutory maximum, quote, or based on the sentencing court's reliance on any constitutionally impermissible factor. Here,
the district court, during the Rule 11 inquiry, ever draw the appellant's attention to that particular provision?
I don't think he drew his attention to that particular provision.
Supposed to, right?
Well, in any event, Judge.
And in fact, at the end of the sentencing, didn't he tell the appellant he had a right to appeal?
He did indicate that he had a right to appeal, yes.
So you've got a fellow here who told a bunch of conflicting things, apparently. Should we hold him then to a waiver?
I hadn't considered that factual juxtaposition, Your Honor. I would suggest that he did say that he had confirmed with the attorney about the plea agreement, so I think it would be fair to hold him to this. But even if the court were disinclined to do that,
that's the whole purpose of 11. Rule 11 is we don't trust what the conversations may have been between the lawyer and the defendant. The defendant's supposed to hear it from the judge.
Well, Judge, I just have one last point. If I may make one point, Judge, and that is this. This argument fails on the merits in any event. And this was glossed over missed entirely by Mr. Rahim's appellate brief, and that's this. Mr. Rahim expressly conceded the accuracy of the loss amounts at the sentencing hearing, and I cite the court to, I gave the page cites in our brief, pages 49 and 64 through 65 of the sentencing transcript. He conceded to the amount of the benefits he received, and in the face of an offer of proof from the government, Mr. Rahim also conceded that as a recipient of SSI benefits, he also automatically would have received Title 19 Medicaid benefits and also would have received a letter to that effect.
So rather than get all tangled foot in a murky issue of waiver, the fact of the matter is if you reach the merits on the sentencing, there's nothing there. That's
exactly
your point, right?
Honor. Yes. Unless there are any further questions, the government relies on its brief for its remaining argument. All right. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes.
In regards to what Mr. Campbell has said, that Mr. Rahim has waived the issue in regards to appealing the motion to withdraw his plea, until a defendant says the words, I am guilty, after a plea colloquy with the judge, the person is not entering the plea. A person can say and go through the entire plea questioning with the judge, and up until the point that he says, yes, I am guilty, he has not entered a plea. I think it is one of the most important things, and that's why judges spend so long with a defendant questioning them about whether or not they're giving up their rights, and they know they're giving up their rights, and what rights they're giving up. So until that person says, I am guilty, they are not. Therefore, in regards to this case and this appellant who has issues in regards to the understanding of the English language, where as far as I can recall, there's nothing in the record to indicate that even though he has been here, been in this country since 1978, whether or not he has received English training, whether or not he has received classes in the English language, and how he runs his business, whether or not the business is done in the English language or another language. It is extremely important that this district court should have spent more time with a person of this nature to make sure that he understood and was doing what is in his best interest in entering a plea knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. And for him to have had a 15 or 20 minute or 30 minute evidentiary hearing so that he could explain to the court what he had in his head at the time that he entered the plea would have been very important to this person. So therefore, based upon the submission of the briefs and what has been stated, unless there's any questions, I have nothing further. Thank you,
Counsel. Thank you, Counsel. We will proceed to case number